There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello, and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking, and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Laura Laker.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Ned Bolting. For once, not doing the introduction, that's going to be Laura today.
I'm looking forward to
how this is going to go.
Did it. This time we are talking about online disinformation with Armil Khan, founder of Valent, a company that deals with disinformation by understanding who is behind it, what methods they use, and who they seek to manipulate. I came across you because I saw a piece about ULEZ and a disinformation campaign that had paid £168,000 to spread kind of negative messaging around the introduction of ULEZ, which happened this summer and was quite, well, contentious. And so I thought it'd be interesting to talk to you about what you do and how you came to do it.
This sounds mad.
So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yes, it was totally mad.
Yeah.
And it continues to be mad.
Yeah.
This is
quite a long-running thing for you. So you were a journalist before you founded this company. You worked for the BBC and Reuters, and you first encountered disinformation during the Arab Spring, which was in the 2010s.
Yeah.
And then you did some kind of work for Chatham House and the government, and then you were looking around for a company that did basically what you're doing now, and it didn't exist, and then you decided to start your own company.
Yeah, that was exactly it. And the reason was, well, company or think tank or somebody who is some entity that was working in a practical way on the issue of technical manipulation. So there were a lot of people working on fact-checking. And I just thought there's nothing on technical manipulation, which seemed to be really the issue to me. Mm. And that's what I spent time writing about and researching.
Yeah. And that's the kind of mechanics behind, it's generally on social media, right? It's the kind of mechanics behind spreading.
So it's not generating the lie, it's how do you replicate, how do you spread the lie?
Yeah, I think there's something, when there's a lot of stuff about disinformation, misinformation, and it's almost a victim of its own success because there's people talk about it so much that all the terminology sort of gets muddled up and there's no kind of real sort of structure to what the issue is. Misinformation means something specific, which is where you spread wrong information, but in a way that your intent is honest. Disinformation is you're spreading false information dishonestly.
Okay.
So the difference is between, say, seeing something on a WhatsApp group and thinking, oh, that seems worrying, and sharing it without necessarily realising that it's false, and that's kind of misinformation.
Yes.
Whereas disinformation is more what you look at, which is companies kind of tweaking things, spreading falsehoods.
So you could drill down a bit further. We look at technical manipulation. Mm. So that means, are people using, when we say technical, are they manipulating accounts, the way accounts share? So are they using special bits of software that you can't actually buy in the open market that control loads of accounts to trick the algorithms on Facebook, Instagram, whatever, and essentially make something way more viral, way more popular than it would have been in reality?
Yeah. So you like some, you get, you Whoa. Do a post, it gets loads of likes,
you might
and get, it gets
you might
up.
See this on video because we're trying to record it. But if you don't see it on video, Ned's mind has just been blown and his eyes are just totally.
Emoji.
Oh, I've just got so many questions about this. But anyway, but special bits of kit that you can't buy that manipulate the algorithm. I want one of them.
You can buy it with Bitcoin.
Oh really? Oh, only with Bitcoin.
Okay, right. Wow. Anyway, so go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So so you kind of discovered this was happening. Well, you've discovered this was happening with various things. And one of the things you and your team were interested in was ULEZ, because obviously it was a huge deal. So a lot of social media chat around it, a lot of news pieces, big politically as well with the by-election in North London. And yeah, so what happened?
Well, we are, as a company, the way we work is that we are content agnostic. So we look at the manipulation rather than the content. So whereas a fact checker would look at the issues and say, is it true, is it not true? We look at the activity that's happening behind the information. So we keep, as a company, we are really heavily tech-based. So the way we work is that we get lots of different contracts, we do lots of different work, we make software, we use it, people use it, pay us for it. We save about 20% of our capacity for passion projects, essentially. Like, what do we work on stuff that we think is important for a start, just in terms of what's happening in society, but also what is the methodology out there that we find really troubling, fascinating. I think we should look at it to keep our skills up, you know, like new ways of doing things are constantly being developed. And ULEZ was one of those. So it was clearly something that was a big national conversation, even though it's a London thing, but there was clearly attracting way more attention than just beyond like a normal London policy issue would do. And when we started looking at it, we could see little signals, quite big signals, that not all was right here. This wasn't a completely organic conversation.
So when you say you started looking at it, what do you mean, what's it?
So the conversation online, you could start with the hashtag. How many hashtags are discussing it? What sort of accounts are there?
Which platforms are we talking about? The big ones, like so, which
Twitter,
Facebook,
Telegram, Instagram. I mean, Reddit. But we, for this investigation, we looked at Twitter because when we do these sort of passion projects, we don't have all that much budget to put to it. So you kind of got to prioritize.
Yep. Okay.
And if something dodgy is happening on Twitter, although Twitter isn't like Twitter has an outsized influence because it's not where most people are actually on Facebook, but what happens on Twitter tends to get picked up by journalists and sort of informs our national conversation.
Yeah.
So if you see dodgy stuff happening on Twitter, you can be pretty sure it's going to be happening on Facebook, it's going to be happening on Reddit and elsewhere.
So it punches above its weight,
yeah,
because of the kinds of people who use it and how much influence they wield.
Totally.
You hear politicians, don't you, sort of almost being guided by Twitter, even though it's not real life, but they very much feel like what's being talked about on Twitter is a barometer for the points of the moment.
I think all of us who use the platform fall victim to that, actually, yeah. Yes. A little bit.
Yeah.
I'll put my hand up.
Because then you speak to normal people and they're like, what are you about?
But so you noticed it on... So you noticed something happening with this conversation and with these hashtags?
Yeah, so the kind of thing we notice typically when the sort of radar pings and we go, that doesn't look right, is say accounts that are, we have a criteria, so we have a really systematic way of looking at it. But if you were just looking at it, you'd go, hang on a minute, that account was set up 3 days ago, has done nothing but tweet about this particular issue, carries a lot of cut and paste, you know, content where maybe there's no name, there's no faces. Anonymity is not a problem on Twitter as it is on Facebook. But when you notice an account doing several of those activities and being anonymous and having a fake name, then you start thinking, and then you see a lot more accounts doing it, then you start thinking, okay, all in all, this adds up to quite a lot of inauthentic behavior. Whereas any one of those by themselves might not necessarily be, but when you put them all together in a bucket and you look at that bucket and you go, well, that doesn't look right.
And was this on both sides of the argument? I mean, how do we frame this argument? I suppose pro and anti ULEZ would be the simplest way of breaking it down. But did this phenomenon, were you picking it up on both sides or just one side of the argument?
Mostly on the anti ULEZ. I can't think of an example where all the criteria were met on pro ULEZ. And even the accounts that were complaining about ULEZ, they weren't, when they say, oh, well, look at the other side, and we see this quite a lot, they don't point to other people on Twitter doing what they do. They point to mainstream media. They go, oh, well, we're just organizing because the BBC is an arm of state propaganda.
Yeah.
So we are anti that. They see themselves as actors who do this kind of activity, see themselves as a counterbalance to mainstream media mostly, not other people on Twitter doing the same thing that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow.
My final question before I allow Laura or even Adam a question, but I find this so interesting. I suppose before you sort of like go any further into this story, I was quite intrigued at the beginning when you said we are non-content driven or non-content specific, which kind
content
of implied
agnostic.
Content agnostic is your phrase, which implied to me we're neutral. Mm-hmm. We're not taking any, we're not coming at it from a particular, that's kind of what you meant. But then you said, but 20% of what we do is passion driven, which kind of implied to me the opposite of that almost, that perhaps you were coming at this from a particular persuasion. Would that be a reasonable conclusion to kind of draw?
The passion isn't content driven either. It's methodology driven. So, right.
So this wasn't, like, you weren't passionate about ULEDs one way or another. You were passionate about this kind of activity.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to, I come from, my journalistic sort of training was at a Wire, and Wires are very like keen on being, you know, as objective as possible. So that's kind of inculcated in my background as a journalist. And then what we do as a company as well sort of reflects part of that. So it's the passion is that we are very serious about the integrity of our information space. So we look at activity that threatens that integrity. So it wouldn't necessarily be, oh, we see somebody saying something and we don't really like it, so we're going to check them out, which maybe is more of a fact-checking approach. We think these facts are dodgy, so we're going to have a look at them. It's more like, oh, we're seeing these photos and videos that look like they're generated by DALL-E or Midjourney or some sort of AI generative thing. That's really odd. Like, why are they promoting a random company in wherever? This is just weird. Mm-hmm. Let's check it out.
Mm. And what you found with the ULEZ campaign was I think your article on this said was one of the most advanced manipulation efforts you'd seen in nearly 4 years of examining activity in Africa, the Middle East and Europe.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah. So there's a kind of context to this. We all these kind of activities are global, as we all know. Some countries, geographies are more closely policed than others. And by that, I mean the social media platforms take activity that happens there more seriously. There's more of a media, news media, that'll look at activity. And in the places where that doesn't happen, they're just not as highly prioritized. So Sudan was a great example of a place where we were looking at the online activity going on.
Mm. Is that via IP addresses? Or how do you find people from... Oh, you just look on the location of their Twitter...
We'll look at the conversation in that in that place.
Okay. And you can search on Twitter by location.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to search. If you were looking, I mean, just the way it works, if you were really interested in, say you were Sudanese and you were based in the UK and you want to know what's happening back in Sudan, there'll be hashtags talking about, you know, whatever issue. And you look at that hashtag, you look at that account, you'll see various, you'll become part of that conversation just from a few clicks. So we can
but
look
you were
at
tracing
that.
An unusual amount of people in Sudan, notionally, who are very interested in London's ultra-low emission zone.
It wasn't a link between that, it was the methodology. So it was back to the methodology. What happened was we've spent quite a bit of time working in Sudan, and there is a methodology that is used because there's a conflict going on.
Yeah.
And both sides are using dodgy manipulative techniques.
Oh, okay, right.
Without a
right.
doubt. One side is more sophisticated.
Mm. Propaganda.
And what they're doing is they're using accounts in a way, like mass manipulation of accounts to make their side's talking points more visible on Twitter than the other side's. That was the most sophisticated we'd seen. So not to get too technical, but essentially it means you or I or anyone looking at it as normal viewers wouldn't really notice it, but we would know that we just see one particular argument a lot. And if Twitter comes and closes that down and says, oh, this is dodgy, let's close it down, the accounts that are more visible, more valuable because they've been around longer and they're not the ones likely to get closed down. It'll be some low-grade accounts that they set up 3 days ago and are just there to kind of give legitimacy to the other accounts. So we thought, wow, this is pretty sophisticated. In London, it was technically, as our CTO says, just really sharp. It was the same kind of methodology. There was no sloppiness. As he would say, the engineers were really on their game on that.
So, I mean, this is all fascinating. Don't want to do a Ned and so I understand it. I'm joking. No, it's a joke. It's a joke. It raises a question. I can understand why people would do this. But I can understand why people would pay to do this. But that bit still feels sort of a bit odd because, you know, yes, of course, there are some vested interests in this, but it's a little bit different to like fossil fuel lobby maybe doing it. So is there any indication of who's been paying for this, whether this is individuals, whether this is organised, this is companies? And whether that the money that's been spent, that's been quoted, is...
It's 168 grand.
Yeah, so whether that's on the technology or whether that's on what people would understand as kind of Facebook ads and things like that to get it in front of new people, like we see political parties doing during election cycles.
Yeah, so the number was an estimate of the number of accounts that we found, the way they were being used to amplify the talking points. And they were clearly fake accounts and fake follows and fake shares and et cetera. You can go in and buy those. So when we did the thread, we screen grabbed them. I mean, there's, you know, dark web little companies that will, like, if you look hard enough, you'll find something.
It was a Twitter thread that you also put on your website as a kind of news blog piece. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in there as well, we had that screen grab of this company. And it's, we're not suggesting that particular company was, what they're doing is not actually allowed on the terms and conditions of social media companies, but they're clearly, you know, offering something that's not really legitimate.
Mm.
Yeah.
And there will be others. There are others. We know there are. So we took the number of accounts and what their pricing was and said, okay, this is
basically took their rate card. Yeah, their rate card. What you'd seen.
And it's a market, so they're sort of about the same. That's follows, that's getting follows. And then there's another element of that is where an actor might want to control 100,000 accounts, 100 accounts, well, however many. And they can get any, so you guys can write a post, put it on your website, and you can use a bit of software that will ping that link between hundreds, if not thousands, of Facebook, Twitter accounts or whatever. What happens then is the algorithms go, oh, this is a really popular bit of content, and you get an algorithmic boost, and that stuff just ends up being on people. You start dominating people's timelines. There are companies that also offer that, and The Guardian had a really good investigative story about that, and that company, they went in with like secret cameras and filmed this company, the people running the company, and they gave them a quote. You know, they said, if you want us to do this, we'll do, we'll you know, whatever it was. So that's how we arrived at that figure. Now, after we published the investigation, Rory Stewart on the Rest is Politics podcast, are we allowed to mention other podcasts?
Yes, if they're in the league of the Rest is Politics. Okay. I think we're on page 173 in the... it's a joke. We're number one in active travel.
And in our
in
own
the
heads.
UK. Yeah, but go.
I'm sure they'll be tickled to be mentioned. So Rory Stewart said, when he was talking about it, he said, well, you know, it's fine. I actually think this number is an underestimation because when I was running for London Mayor, I had people coming to me and saying they do exactly this stuff. And they were charging hundreds of thousands a month.
Yeah.
So, right. You know, clearly hundreds of thousands is the area you're in if you're doing this kind of stuff. How much that exactly is probably depends from company to company.
Is it I don't know why I'm trying to look on the sort of bright side of it, but is it plausible that somebody was just very good at this, like very good at computers, and therefore, because I think this £160,000 figure, while it's done at a rate card, I'm thinking that people listening to this and people reading it in a newspaper might think, well, that must be sort of dirty money. Why would they want to spend that? But could it just be that the belief system of somebody was so great against ULEZ, which is their right to do so, and some people think it's good, some people think it's bad, that they just wanted to do this, and they took it upon themselves. I imagine they're in like a, you know, a dark room in Enfield or something, and just using all this kind of quite advanced tech. But it was actually their cleverness that was, rather than the shadiness of money that's changing hands. And then you have to ask questions, well, why would someone? Because I feel more.
No, do you think so? You're suggesting it's just an enthusiastic amateur.
I feel more comfortable thinking it's an enthusiastic amateur that's just really good at computers
and really passionate about users.
Really doesn't like users, because that's their right if they don't like users.
Is that possible? Could you do that? Yeah.
So there's a couple of things here. If you're an enthusiastic amateur who's really sort of politically fired up by whatever issue, let's say anti four, and you sit at your kitchen table and get download. So this is where it starts veering into the not legitimate. So you can download the software, you can run 100,000 accounts or whatever. You can technically do all those things, but that is technical manipulation. Mm. So,
which is not allowed under any social media.
Is it illegal?
It's not illegal because social media companies don't make our laws, but by their laws, it's not allowed. So by their terms and conditions, you're not meant to use the platform in that way.
Yeah,
but it's not fraudulent in the same, like the law of the land, it's not fraudulent. There is no law against it. Or?
There's no, we don't have it at the moment, any law that says you can't do this stuff. The onus, the way the legal system deals with this whole issue, is there's a lot of onus on the platforms, and it's becoming increasingly more so with what's happening in the EU.
So long as the message isn't breaking the law, all you're doing is manipulating the publishing of that message effectively, aren't you? So if the message is within the law, then there's no law broken.
Yeah, so exactly. So, you know, if there's certain things that you say, like glorifying Nazis or something like that, then, you know, it's the same
or
as if
slander,
you did it.
Or lie, yeah,
defamation.
Yeah,
that would fit within a legal framework.
Yeah. I mean, it is, this whole area is, you know, if you think about it, we've had newspapers for, you know, a couple of hundred years, and all these things, precedent, there's law, and things happen. And how you deal with these things kind of washes out, and you have a kind of established way of doing it. There's so much when it comes to social media that is still up in the air.
Yeah.
So social media platforms will argue legally, not to oversimplify it, but they will say essentially that they are like a notice board in a town square. So you can't sue them if somebody put up, you know, something praising Nazis, because that's not their view. They, like, in the same way you wouldn't sue the parish church because it's notice board and somebody came and put something dodgy on it. But other people say that's not the case. You have some responsibility. You make money out of it, for example, or whatever. So, and there's no settled, you know, issue on this. What we have are the terms and conditions that the social media companies themselves adhere to and have committed to publicly. The way we operate, where we operate as a company, is we don't get involved in the murky stuff around what is fact, right? Because that's subjective. It's like, you know, that we've seen that a lot with elections in the US. Well, you would say it's a lie. We don't think it's a lie. We have an alternative fact, and things get, we, or same thing with incitement to hatred.
Yeah.
But technical manipulation of the platforms themselves are quite decisive about it. If you read their terms and conditions, it just says we don't, you know, you have hate speech, you know, like 2 pages. Technical manipulation, like 3 lines. We don't allow it. You do it. We take you down. Done.
Very, right. Very clear. And these companies that are selling these services, basically, they use sort of vaguely concealed euphemisms, I think you described them as. So they'll I don't know what the terms
it's
are,
but
they're
growth hacking is one that I quite
growth
like.
Hacking.
Growth hacking. Yeah. But they're selling spreader accounts, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you sometimes see them, and you just sometimes, you know, then you don't have to look that far in the dodgy corners of the internet. You know, you don't need a Tor browser or something to find them. You can just, you know, you can just do the, it'll be the, you do a Google search and it's the stuff on page 4 or 5 that you never get to.
Yeah.
But
I guess if it's not illegal, then they're not illegal. I mean, they're sort of operating a service. If the social media companies don't like them, they can kind of kick them out. But
they're not hiding
law.
From the government. They're hiding from getting sued by social media companies.
Is there something about Twitter or X, as it's now known, that, because I'm tempted, going to reveal my politics probably here, but obviously, like, my politics is very different to Elon Musk's politics. And I've noticed since he took over the platform that I'm seeing more stuff in my feed that I ordinarily probably would have never seen. And then you've got the whole verified thing where you can now pay to be verified, so, and you get more visibility if you are verified. And obviously that's just the market, and that's their right to be, you know, if they want to get verified. But I'm starting to see way more verified accounts and way more accounts saying things that I normally wouldn't see, and not just stuff that I don't like, but, you know, stuff that I've just got also got no interest in. Like, it's a bad algorithmic choice. Is there any evidence that with the change in hands of the platform, that stuff that maybe ordinarily might not have been seen in an echo chamber, perhaps, is now getting in front of more and more people just because of the way the algorithms are changing? And you could argue that's possibly a good thing for discussion and debate, but also it lends itself to the kind of issues that we've seen in spreading more misinformation much more broadly.
Yeah. I think there's a few companies and think tanks, research teams that have looked into it and said that there is more misinformation and disinformation. I haven't seen very much on the why. I think, and I don't think anybody seriously said that Elon Musk just, you know, supercharge all this stuff that he likes that maybe, you know, that maybe you don't like. I think there's some sort of practical steps that Elon Musk, when he took over, fired a lot of the people on the trust and safety committee, the trust safety teams.
Yeah.
That has an impact on what, because those guys who ever have, I mean, there, I think there was a few hundred, if not a thousand odd people who were looking at trust and safety issues. And if they're not there, that filter's gone. So you're going to see what kind of stuff that is. I don't know. The selling verification definitely results. I mean, I can say from what we've seen, one of those things that sort of again sent us these signals, oh, this is weird, was verified accounts using AI generative pictures, visuals, to mock up celebrities with some really shocking stuff, like the Pope
in a puffer jacket.
Well, that was more the fun stuff. But it was one. Two that stick in my head: Bear Grylls being arrested by the police, halt for a dramatic photo, saying, "Find out what Bear Grylls knew. Click this link." Verified account goes to just some advertising thing. There was another one that looked like it was a vigil for Daniel Radcliffe, as if he died, which is pretty dark. And again, verified account. So, you know, you change rules and then people get bad actors use them, and they try and that to us seems a bit clickbaity. They just were trying to just make something up really cheap to set up these kind of photos and just get, you know, as many clicks as they could to their website in the hope that 1% of people buy something.
So this is probably way outside of the scope of your inquiry, but kind of we encourage us all to have a view on this, I suppose, that given what you have apparently established about the way that this particular debate has been seemingly manipulated by whoever, for whatever reason, at whatever price, on this particular platform, what do we think is the actual real world consequence of that, given that we started this debate by saying actually X is a bit of a small thing that carries a bit too much weight perhaps, but it does seem to me to have gone a bit nuts. I wouldn't have rewind a couple of months, I wouldn't have imagined for a second that the Blade Runners would exist as a group of brave warriors who are dismantling the equipment that is supposed to be there to enforce ULEZ. That strikes me as a sort of unusually active consequence of this entire debate. It does appear, and, you know, let alone the Uxbridge by-election and then the joining of the dots in the Conservative Party subsequent to the Uxbridge by-election, which you could argue has led to a raft of really very controversial and major policy reversals by Rishi Sunak, all potentially as a result of this debate about the emission zone. Yeah. I mean, it's
huge ripples.
Potentially. It's very hard to prove, isn't it? Yeah. But it does strike me that... And is that one of the reasons why you felt this was worth your time looking at this particular case?
This and others were worth our time because we feel that this kind of manipulation on issues of public debate will have the long term and are having a long term impact on the integrity of our national decision making systems. It's what they essentially do. You were asking, what do? Is they degrade our collective ability to look at facts and come to a decision as to what the way forward is. Ultimately, they aim, and this is why the disinformation sort of broadly, and you know, the sort of academic studies will tell you this, they aim to, at their heart, take away the idea that there are some basic fundamental facts we can agree on. Great example being whether or not the Earth is round or flat. So it just removes them all. And then it becomes a lot harder because every single small thing has to be debated.
Everything's questioned.
Everything's questioned. And then you can't say, well, you know, you've got this fact, I've got this fact, look it up in the encyclopedia or look at the BBC. Or
you can do your own research.
Yeah, I don't trust.
How do you do that? So it just causes gridlock in our sort of national debate, in our national decision-making systems. Wherever you are on the political platform, it becomes really difficult to enact a policy, to do anything. It just becomes, you know, from my point of view, and the reason we do what we do is it just comes down to who can pay for the most sophisticated manipulation capabilities.
And you might have seen the longer term impacts of this from the Arab Spring. I'm not sure if you've sort of kept tracks. Obviously, you've said that you initially saw disinformation there, and that was a good 10, sort of 13 years ago now. I don't know if you're aware of the ripple effects. I guess it's hard to attribute, but...
I think what really struck me about the Arab Spring issue was that from an information perspective as a journalist, somebody who's trained as a journalist, was that as a society in the UK and the US and Western Europe, North America, we tend to think that new things happen in our bit of the world and then get adopted elsewhere because those places are, you know, less economically advanced or whatever. But with this kind of stuff, the systems actually are tested in faraway places and then come to America or England. Like, I saw this stuff happening at the Arab Spring in 2013.
It was a big moment for Twitter, that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and Facebook. But when we really started talking about it was the Trump election and the investigations into Russian, you know, manipulation.
Cambridge Analytica.
And all that kind of stuff. So if people had been watching, those methodologies were being tested in war zones, in, you know, authoritarian states, where you could get away with it if you were doing it, and then brought here. So we do keep an eye. Some of our work still involves looking at places in Africa and the Middle East, quite a bit of our work. And one of the reasons we might, you know, decide to use our spare capacity to look at something over there is, one, because it's an active war zone and people will be suffering violence, being killed, but also because those methodologies could one day find themselves in other parts of the world.
Mm. Yeah, there was the Philippines. There's a journalist, Maria Ressa, who has become very famous for her work over in with Rappler in the Philippines. And she talked about active kind of online campaigns against individuals to try and kind of basically break what the work that she was doing as a journalist. And yeah, the social media manipulation there was very, very advanced. And I guess it's another example of what can happen, and then it gets taken up by other parts of the world. But it also reminds me of Hypernormalization, that film, that quite disturbing film by what's his name, Adam? No.
Yes, I've forgotten the name.
And he talks about basically this confusion that's created by certain actors around the world, and Russia and Putin was one example. Just sort of building arguments around different things, so people just feel bombarded and unable to basically cope and to make decisions and to feel that they have any agency in their lives and in society, and it becomes overwhelming for people.
But I think another consequence of all of that, and I think you know your work has highlighted that really well, is when you do get a kind of like, because there are so many issues that are fighting for oxygen on these platforms all the time, and occasionally one of them, for whatever reason, gains a lot of traction, whether it's been manipulated or otherwise, or just, you know, or actually because it is having an impact on people's lives. I think we should probably recognise that. ULEZ is not a perfect policy.
Yeah.
And there are many people who are adversely affected by it, indisputably. And it's tough. It's a tough policy for some people to sort of have to get over.
Yeah, in London, yeah.
Completely. I would totally go along with that. But I think I'm so struck by how it's become this flashpoint, you know, that I think the way in which we are informed in our thinking by these platforms, whether or not that's conscious or unconscious, because of the ripple effect, means that when policy goes against us, like when something is enacted by government that we don't like, we are inflamed and enraged and have to take a position. It's very hard to remain neutral. You take a position, and if it's gone against you, so to speak, what we seem to be losing, and it's really important and significant loss, I think, is we are losing that sense of, yeah, but this is how democracy works. you know, you win some, you lose some. Policy goes for and against you, and then every 4 or 5 years you get a chance to change, bring the other lot in. So the feeling that I share, and I would imagine the people who oppose EULAs share, is that nothing feels democratic any longer. My voice is not heard. And I think that these platforms tap into that deep fear that you are not being listened to, and that nothing, and that democracy has vanished, you know, because you're... Do you see?
Yeah, no, totally. Like, I'm thinking,
and it's a powerlessness ultimately. It's kind of it's an inner rage, isn't it? That I think is very, very, you know, that these algorithms have found a kind of neural pathway right into the heart of that feeling, and that's where the danger lies, I think.
I guess it links I think it links to single issues as well, and that's exacerbated a lot in by elections, but maybe less so in general elections, which is, you know, I think a good thing, because I think people accept that by-elections are often anomalies, or often, you know, quite specific
protest phenomenon.
Same with referendums, you know, and whatever. Because there's a couple of things. One is the kind of dead cat strategy that politicians talk about. You know, give them something so shocking or something to focus on, and it ignores all the kind of long-term, whether it's managed decline of public services or whatever people would say. It gives them a short-term focus. And I think that is something we should, you know, be mindful of. And reasons, if you support clean air policies, I think reason to be cheerful would be that away from the short-term focus, you've got this kind of general opinion polling and general support for policies. And if you zoom out, which is hard sometimes, but if you zoom out over time, you realise that actually this is not the biggest thing in their life, they're not super against it, etc. I think
Lost the ability to zoom out.
Yeah, and by-elections and stuff like that exacerbate that. And if you look at Twitter or X, and I think one of the other benefits of this kind of more familiar people become with what to look out for, you know, it's like teaching people not to get phished online for the bank account and things like that. People realise that they don't want to be part of something like that. So if all of a sudden opinions are being shared with quite extreme individuals and you know, they're justifying criminal damage in the same, you know, with Blade Runners and things like that, it puts you in a online, people like sort of, they like to explain what kind of person they are online. We find that in social media and in content, people are looking for identifying with something. And I think the less heated it becomes, and it just becomes about general things, people generally gravitate towards quite sensible, middle of the road decisions. But I think one of the kind of concerns on this is, because it happens over such a short period of time, by the time your report's great, but it's too late. By the time it's happened, all those democratic decisions have been made, and it's the pace that these things take hold. We've seen over the recent weeks with XL bully dogs and things like that, you know, policies being made on the hoof in a week and things just being changed. So it's this Twitter storm, which is the worrying thing. And if we can slow it down a little bit and start to just have debates and talk, I mean, that just sounds like good democracy, right? But the more we do that, I'm confident the more common sense will prevail.
One of the things that this kind of stuff does is it's designed to make a 15% position or a 10% position look like a 55, 60% position.
Yeah, right. Yes, yes.
So that's one of the reasons why we focus on taking out, when we do a full investigation, part of that, one of the steps will be, let's strip out the fakery. And where are you actually at? You know, what's the state of the debate? And you will find that it's 15% or 10% or 5%. Extremes tend to be, you know, unless you're in a really, you know, unusual scenario. And even then, they tend not to be like 50, 60%. But insurgent political actors are incentivized to tell you that they are the majority. So you think about, you know, the phrases like silent majority, or, you know, Steve Bannon saying, I remember listening to him on a podcast and he said, hey, why should we compromise on whatever? We are the 60% in this country, in the US. And any polling will tell you the kind of views that he espouses are 5 to 10, 15%. So, and he's probably clever enough to think, you know, to be saying that while knowing that his entire media operation is geared to make his position look like it's 50, 60%. But what happens when journalists, political actors and others think, oh, they are 50-60%. Mm. You know, we need to start thinking about that in our policy. We need to have a policy that we can get these guys behind because I need to win my next election.
The Nigel Farages.
And maybe, yes, and you know, sort of extreme and fringe politicians and insurgent politicians, whatever political persuasion. You could have politicians and journalists in any country thinking, well, you know, we legitimately have to, they are a part of this country's, you know, views. You know, we have to reflect that. But what if they're not?
Yeah.
You know, what if we're just not taking out the fakery?
You did start to see, I don't know what I would have thought to be fringe politicians like Nigel Farage, who didn't have a great following, being presented on national news all the time. And it did seem rather bizarre at the time. I guess
and the more it's discussed, the more it legitimises is everything.
Perpetuating, yeah. You're obviously an expert in this. What can people do if they see stuff that they... I mean, you can tell what these accounts are. They tend to be new, like you said. They've sometimes you can buy like 300 followers.
Someone was impersonating Chris Boardman recently, and I notified him.
Of all the people to impersonate.
But, you know, but you think now, that's my original thought, but you think now he's now effectively a government czar for active travel in a world of sort of anti-motorist kind of discussion. So they just basically, they did Chris__Boardman, and I nearly got caught out. But I looked at the account thinking, oh yeah, it would have been registered August 2023.
And he could
retro registered in June 2012.
Yeah.
So what you can do now is you can have an old account for nothing. It's totally random. Mm. Change it to a name, wait 3 days, then pay for a verified tick. It's not as simple as just looking at the...
A lot of the ones that you've seen were like, maybe for an individual, but yeah, a lot of the ones that you saw were kind of newer accounts, maybe 300 followers that they bought from somewhere. You can buy followers. And they were retweeting. I don't know if there's something that everyday people can do, social media users can do when they suspect that this stuff is happening.
Yeah, it's getting harder. So when we started doing what we do in 2020, you could tell because the same text would be repeated across multiple sites. Mm. And then a few months after that, whoever was doing that would do alphabetic alteration. So, you know, an L replaced with a 1 and stuff like that. A couple of underscores.
On the usernames?
On text, like an article. But then it would be the same article on multiple accounts. So we were manually able to do it. Mm. Now, you can't really do it manually. So you need AI and you need, you know, tech tools to do it. Because you can get on ChatGPT and before that, something like Jasper.ai, and you can say... You can type in, you know, 4 prompts, whatever topic you're into. Why cycling sucks, you know, in the voice of Joe Rogan, make it funny, press go, you've got an article. Press go again, you've got another article. You just keep putting that on 50, 60, 70.
You can go, give me 1,000 different tweets on why you les is a bad idea, and you'll get 1,000 different, slightly different tweets.
Which means it's then harder
impossible to look
for. So it's an arms race, and we're constantly developing new ways. So we couldn't, if we'd started what we do now... We wouldn't have had the resources to have the tech to do it. But because we started in 2020, we could still do it manually and build up our methodology. But it just, you know, it's going to get, the next is going to be generative AI and videos and all that kind of stuff. So what could the question, you know, you asked was what could normal people do back in 2020? You know, there were certain things we would put them on our, you know, social media, like look for little hints of photoshopping of pictures, look if this matches this, that kind of stuff. And you can still kind of do that. But I think whatever we tell people, it'll change in a month or 2 months. So I think that I say there's a little bit of hesitation because it's a bit of a pain to do and that'll put people off. But I would interrogate the sources. Just look to see if it makes sense. Look to just do a little bit of checking like you did, you know, would Chris Boardman's account be, you know, registered? And, you know, would it be... And it gets harder because now it might have a blue tick. So, but you do have to do that, I think, if you are sufficiently invested in an issue to make sure that you are able to take a decision on that issue. The flip side of that is obviously, I think what is actually happened to most people is they just go, well, just too hard and I've got things to do.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't care. Like ULEZ, you know, transport generally, this is the, you know, why what's happening is quite maddening is because... From an electoral point of view, people just don't care. Like when YouGov poll voters on the things that really matter to them, it's cost of living crisis, it's the NHS, et cetera, the things you'd expect. Climate change does quite high. Transport's something like 4%. or something, like, you know,
when it goes wrong, people care, but they don't think they care
in the short term.
Then.
But in the long term, they don't. Even the most, you know, committed of people are not going to vote on the general election based on bus franchising or something like that. You know, it's so yeah. People don't care, and therefore, if they don't care, they're not going to interrogate it, and then they'll say, "Oh, did you hear about this ULEZ thing?" And the amazing thing about ULEZ, right, is that so many people thought they were affected. You know, there was that video of an interview of a guy in a Tesla in outer London being interviewed by the TV, and he thought he was going to have to pay ULEZ.
Yeah, same as the inheritance tax.
Yes, and that will be the same thing.
60% of people think they're going to be affected. 3.5% of estates pay it.
Yeah, and that's the genius. If you don't look, if you don't care enough to look into it.
Yeah.
Oh, just close your own accounts and read a book.
Yeah.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
An AI-generated book.
Brilliant.
Super interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
For coming on. Very interesting. You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor has been Claire Mansell. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate and review us and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it.
Bye.
Bye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.